Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Justin.
And I'm Lucy.
And together we are the hosts of Plenty Questions.
It's a very straightforward general knowledge quiz.
We ask you 20 questions, one after the other, 5 second gap in between, and you shout the answers out.
And then you tweet us to let us know how you've got on.
See if you can get 20 out of 20. No one has so far, but that's because we haven't started doing it yet.
But we will. And there's also going to be some fiendish brain teasers. So join us for Plenty Questions.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like listening to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
It's Thursday night. It's just before 10 to 8. It's October the 11th, 1973. And a five-year-old me, Al Needham, is sitting round at Tony Bones's house as the tang of Leicester still hangs thick in the air. Hey up, you pop-crazed youngsters, and welcome to the final part of episode 57 of Chart Music. Let's not fanny about. Let's see if this episode can give itself a proper kick up the arse. Come on, 1973, justify my love.
Hey, what a grand song. What fun we're having. That was Engelbert Humperdinck. Thank you, Eng, and may your humple never dumple. Well, I've been asked by the British Board of Governors to say that it wasn't hello, red brick housing estate, it was goodbye, yellow brick road. And now, my friend Stan!
Everett, surrounded by some girls and a ginger lad, does the obligatory mangling of the last artist's name, apologises for the earlier joke about goodbye Yellow Brick Road, and doesn't even introduce the next band by name. But then again, he doesn't have to, because it's Slade with My Friend Stan.
He says he's been asked by the British Board of Governors, sick. He fluffs his words there. And it wasn't Red Brick Housing Estate. It was goodbye Yellow Brick Road. And I sort of feel like he's joking, but not joking. It may be just a bit of panto that he's doing there. But I would not be surprised if Robin Nash or whoever had a word with him after the previous links, like, fuck off and do it properly, you know? But yeah, he doesn't do it properly. He doesn't even mention Slade. Mm.
We've handled Slade more than a few times on Chart Music. And this, the 14th UK single, is the follow-up to Squeeze Me, Please Me, which became their second single to enter the charts at number one, staying there for 3 weeks in July of this year. It's the lead-off single from the forthcoming LP Old, New, Borrowed and Blue, and their first recording since the car crash that put drummer Don Powell in a coma for 6 days, 3 months ago. As is the style with Slade, My Friend Stan was expected to repeat the success of the last two singles, and the pre-order demand was so huge that 100,000 copies had to be imported into the UK from Germany, but last week it only got to number four, and this week it's nipped up only two places to number two. Although the band have taken the still rare step of recording a promo film in Olympic Studios, in case Powell wasn't up to television appearances, here they are in the Top of the Pop studio. There's a short interview with Don Powell in the latest Melody Maker. He says he's over the worst, but he still has bouts of memory loss. He's using a notebook to jot down what time he's gone to bed and what he has to do the next day. He'd totally forgotten that Jim Lee's brother had filled in for him on the dates that they missed. And he sometimes needs a stick to get about and get in and out of the drum stool.
Yeah.
So, yeah, tricky time for Slade. And, you know, as we know, they've just come back from America because in the previous week's Top of the Pops, they gave out a congratulatory message from a cafe in New York before they started singing We Wish You a Merry Birthday and Looning About.
Right. I wonder, because he's obviously, you know, Don Powell's in a bad way, and he obviously had to be helped to his drum kit, not just for this appearance, but to record the flipping song. And I wonder whether that's why the song isn't, you know, the kind of big, roaring, stomping, glam monster that we might expect from Slade. And it's crazy, isn't it? Just how successful they were, in as much as a song that only gets to number two is actually seen as a miss, really, for Slade.
Yes.
Which is crazy because it's still selling a huge amount. But I do think that, yeah, what happened to Don Powell actually, I'm not saying it had an effect on sales, but that's why I think this record isn't as fully, I don't know, untrammeledly unhinged as like the great Slade tunes that just come roaring at you. It does feel like they're kind of being a bit careful around Don, perhaps.
Here's my question about this song, My Friend Stan. Is it Slade's Shark Jump? Now, we can't call it a total shark jump because Merry Christmas, Everybody, Every Day and Far, Far Away were still to come, which are brilliant singles. But if you look at the run of massive songs before it, so if I read out all of these now, Cause I Love You, Look What You Done, Take Me Back Home, Mama We're All Crazy Now, Goodbye to Jane, Come On Feel the Noise, and Squeeze Me, Please Me. Oh my God, it's a thrilling list just to read. Just to say those song titles out loud gives you a frisson of adrenaline. And then this, it's a bit of a misstep, to say the least.
Yeah.
The thing is, in this week's Melody Maker, we learn that Slade have been working overtime trying to crack America. You mentioned it earlier, the whole thing about Noddy threatening to stick a boot up their arse if they don't stamp their feet and clap their hands. But no way were Americans going to go for a record like this. Not that American success is the measure of quality. Obviously, loads of the greatest bands ever just didn't do it over there.
Yeah, but it's the measure of being exceedingly minted and being able to have your own plane and everything.
It is. And at this particular time, it's clearly what mattered to their manager, Chas Chandler. He's been very bullish about the whole thing, but American audiences are bemused by the sounds of things. Slade apparently went over again and tried in 1975-76. By the time they came back, Britain had moved on. So in a way, fixating in that way on American success fucked their whole career.
Yeah,
Jim Lee wrote this on a piano, and that maybe that I like the theory about Don Powell, you know, maybe not being up to one of their more raucous rock numbers, but the fact that Jim Lee wrote it on a piano, maybe that's another reason why it doesn't rock. It's like Anglo-Saxon umpah. It's a knees-up drinking song. It's knees-up Mother Brown.
Yeah.
This song could not be more British. And it makes me Anglophobic. It makes me hate England. I mean, which never takes much. But I'm not saying there are huge cultural differences between the West Midlands and South Wales. In fact, I would say there are a great many similarities, but a Welsh band would never have written this. So I can see why Americans would have thought, fuck this limey shit when they hear it.
Yeah, completely.
I was assuming that this was written for the American market.
Seriously? Wow.
I don't think so, Al. Not with the words. Not with these words. It's a sly song, this. It's full of innuendo, and Americans are never really going to go for that. The phrase that keeps coming across is, and from the way you black my eye. I know that you're the reason why, is the constant phrase, but there's a confusion about who it's being addressed to a certain extent. Yeah. You know, that doesn't help it get across in America. It's kind of a novelty song about rough sex in a way. It actually surprises me, not that it didn't get to number one, but that it got to number two, that it did that well. He sings it, Noddy, with his usual gruff cheer, but I spend most of this song trying to figure out who the hell it's about and who the hell's being addressed. It's too confusing.
Yeah, me too,
you know, I think it's a little bit too confusing for an American audience, perhaps.
Yeah, because it's got these supposedly risque lyrics, but depending on the verse, it's Stan's old man, and there's Jack, and there's Pete, and they're all
Pete's
knackered
weak
or ill.
Jack's got an ache in his back.
Yeah, they're all knackered or ill as a result of presumably the woman that Noddy's singing to. And yeah, the refrain, and from the way you black my eye, I know that you're the reason why. And from the way you fix his tie, I know you're getting to him. Which I don't know what's being implied there. I mean, something is, but it's basically my old man's a dustman. And to me, it sounds more like a Wurzels or a Mungo Jerry song than a Slade song.
Yes.
Yeah.
Unless to the eyes, though, right?
Funny old man is his Stan's cock.
Oh, well, yeah. Oh, man.
I never thought of that.
Well, that's only just come to mind now, so.
But when you look at them to the eyes, it's still Slade in their pomp.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You've got Dave Hill with his super yob guitar. Oh, by the way, do you know who's got the super yob guitar now? Do you know who owns it?
Oh, God, was it Thingy Out of Madness? No. Go on.
No. It's Marco Peroni out of Adam the Ant.
Really?
Fucking hell. He posted a picture. Yeah, I don't know how it came to his possession, but he posted a picture of it on Instagram the other day. Chris Foreman out of Madness, he actually commented underneath that photo, but Chrissy Boy from Madness borrowed it for the Shut Up video.
Yeah.
So that's the connection there.
Yeah.
But yeah, visually, Slade are giving it Slade still.
Mm. Yes.
Mm. Noddy's still Noddy with his Victorian industrialist mutton chops and...
But he's calmed down a bit, hasn't he, sartorially? He looks, by Noddy older standards, he looks quite dapper here.
No mirrors on the hat, yeah.
No, and he's got a pair of glasses on.
Yeah, I suppose it's a bit more
sensible. And a nice waistcoat. He looks pretty natty.
He could be in a production of Christmas Carol or something, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, it's kind of that sort of Victorian gentleman look. His voice, I've said this before, it's one of the great rock and roll voices. In the first...
Yeah.
Melody Maker piece about them trying to crack America. His vocals are described as like the rasp of a leather razor strop, which I quite like. And in the second one, the Don Powell interview, Noddy's compared to a Black & Decker hedge trimmer. But either way, that voice, I think, is wasted on material like this. There's a bit of a coda to this, the fact, you know, about the fact it didn't get to number one. According to Dave Kemp, who's a Slade super fan and runs a website about them, Chas Chandler was offered a bribe by David Cassidy's management to delay the release of My Friend Stan so that Daydreamer by David Cassidy could have a clear run at number one.
Right.
Because it was just assumed that a Slade record is going to go at number one.
Yeah.
So, but Chandler wouldn't budge. But obviously it turned out the Cassidy camp needn't have worried because, you know, My Friend Stan didn't reach number one and David Cassidy did.
Yeah, I think it's the problem with the record, I think perhaps the reason it didn't get to number one isn't necessarily a problem with the sound. Noddy's voice is intact. He's doing it with his usual stuff. It's the song that kind of comes across like a raised eyebrow. In a sense, it's kind of not a stance that Slade have taken before. There's humour in Slade songs, without a doubt, but there's a directness as well. This doesn't quite have that. It's more, I don't want to say ironic, but it feels like, a big arch kind of raised eyebrow of a song rather than something that's being entirely confidently delivered. And I think that might be why it didn't, get as big as the other ones. And number two, in Slade world is a failure at this point.
Definitely. And of course, it's the first single in ages that's spelt properly.
Yeah.
I think that's where they went wrong.
I thought of that. Yeah, you're right.
On the cover of the song and in the advertising, the N is kind of like mirror imaged, flipped over.
Like Simple Minds or Manic Street Preachers when they're doing that Russian business.
Yeah. Not good enough, Slade.
No, must try harder. They do for their next one, you know, it's back to the big hits, but it's a bit of a misfire, this.
There's more of a convivial atmosphere, isn't there, on this one? They're sort of in a pit, surrounded by the kids, including a gaggle of women who seem to have been bussed in by the band because they've all got the promotional material. And one of them, who's festooned with My Friend Stan badges, claps a little bit too hard and topples off the platform at one point.
I didn't notice that, that's amazing. I'm going to go back and look.
Yeah, you must. So the following week, My Friend Stan dropped one place to number three, where it stayed for 2 weeks. But the follow-up, Merry Christmas Everybody, righted the ship when it entered the charts at number one in the middle of December, staying there for 5 weeks. That's more like it.
Hello.
That was Slade. Hello. Bet you've got a fine set of udders, my dear. And now, straight from America, we have a magnificent group. What are going to do their second in a long series of tuits. And it's Limmy and Family Cooking and their latest smasheroo, Dreamboat!
We're immediately pitched into another section shoehorned in by Top of the Pops to avoid sticking to the charts. Tip for the Top, which is represented by spinning Art Deco graphic of four women in flowing dresses holding each word on a white film case. After Everett has finished rurally harassing a blonde girl in the audience, he introduces this week's entrant, Limmy and Family Cooking and Dreamboat. We've covered Limmy Shell and his Big T in chart music number 9, and this is the follow-up to You Can Do Magic, which got to number 3 only last month and is still in the charts at number 47. It's only just come out, so it's not in the charts yet, but it's already been reviewed in Deborah Thomas's Tuesday Scene in the Mirror as a, quote, doobie-doo clap and tambourine bouncer. As they're still in the country doing the club circuit, here they are, straight from a stint at Blighty's in Farnworth to do their pieces in the studio. Again, Everett putting himself about with the ladies.
Oh, God, yeah, he says, you've got a fine set of udders, my dear, to a girl next to him. Mm. And she looks really sort of a bit horrified. And again, it's not okay. You know, he doesn't get, whatever his sexuality is, he doesn't get a get-out for saying creepy stuff to girls.
It's a bit much for Top of the Pops in 1978. I can't imagine Tony Blackburn saying that.
No. And what's most objectionable, in a way, apart from the sexuality of it, it's just, it's always a bad look when TV presenters who are used to TV try and make members of the public look really uncomfortable. Yeah. And that's what I get from that moment.
So, why is this on? Obviously, they've gone, well, this is going to be a hit, so let's get them in and get some film in the can for future episodes. Mm-hmm. They're kind of banking that it's going to be a hit, and they're American, so they're not going to be around in a couple of weeks' time for a return performance. So,
is it the original version of this record that we're hearing? Because I swear down, that guitar solo that starts it all is so out of tune. Ah. And I almost thought this is the BBC Orchestra or something playing it.
Top of the Pops Orchestra are in full effect here, I believe.
Yeah, pretty badly, actually. I think they have had a few points of heavy at this point. And the guitar solo that starts it is really out of tune, to the point where the lead singer seems to grimace having to get through it before she can start singing. But as to why it's on here, it's same problems with Engelbert. Why is this on here? Mm.
We've seen that a few times, haven't we?
When you're a new act and you have a big hit, it's generally the style that, you know, your next single gets somewhere in the charts. So,
yeah. Well, they've already had that sort of tip for the top. This is going to be a hit thing with Engelbert. So this is, I mean, come on. Look at your chart in 1973. There's got to be something better than this or different.
Well, there's loads of decent shit in the charts at the minute. They're not here and Limmy and Family Cooking are. They're in the country. Anything to say, Simon?
Requiem. Requiem, Requiem, Requiem. Erndos Requiem.
Sorry, I needed to do that. Back in the late 90s and early noughties, I did a lot of vinyl-only DJ sets at things like the club night, Uncle Bob's wedding reception, and at people's real-life weddings and birthday parties and such. And a few friends who were regulars at these things told me that they used to play Pricey Bingo, right? Because my set was always quite samey and predictable. There were certain songs I'd always play. And one of those songs was You Can Do Magic by Limmy and Family Cooking, right?
Because it's a fucking tune.
It's amazing. And I was on a mission to revive that song. It's capable of taking you where Scottish Limmy's travel agent cannot. When Limmy, the comedian on his TV show, shows the travel agent the photo of him and his mates on a teenage holiday in Millport and asks for a ticket to there, meaning not the place, but the moment, she's unable to give it to him, and it's such a poignant sketch. But pop music can do that for you. Pop music is your ticket, and You Can Do Magic transports you to the happiest place you can think of. It's one of the most uplifting records I've ever heard. And spinning it on vinyl, whether to a crowd or in my own living room, is a total joy. However, this song is not You Can Do Magic. It's Dreamboat.
No.
And the review in Record Mirror calls it a distinct disappointment after You Can Do Magic. And
yes,
perfectly pleasant without having the coherent drive of its forerunner. And I have to agree. And yeah, we'll sort of factor in the BBC Orchestra doing a disservice to black American artists, as they often do. But even allowing for that, it's just perfectly pleasant, but no more, I would say. It is the first blackface we've seen outside of the chart countdown, what with the spinners being represented by Pan's People. So, you know, that's not nothing. It's like someone's opened a window, at least. I never knew until researching this, by the way, that Limmy is the guy. And the woman singing is his sister, who is confusingly called Jimmy. and also that their records did almost nothing back home in the States. And their main success was here in Britain, similar to Odyssey in that respect. I wonder why that is. I mean, I suppose just one of those things. There was so much amazing soul music coming out of America at that time. Not all of it can be a hit over there, and you know there's always going to be a mismatch, and some bands are going to think, you know what, fuck it, let's concentrate our efforts. I mean, there are probably American soul bands that we've never heard of who are big in Germany. Do you know what I mean? That they'll have thought, fuck it, let's just go somewhere else and charge our arm, you know. And I think that's what went on with this lot, because they stuck around in the UK for several years after, I believe. The other thing I noticed about this performance is that, again, we have some weirdly postmodern directorial decisions. You've got cameras pointing at cameras. It's almost becoming meta, the whole thing. Unless it's just a fuck-up. You can't rule out it just being a fuck-up.
So the following week, Dreamboat entered the charts at number 49, slowly meandered upwards, and a month from now it got to number 31, its highest position. The follow-up, A Walking Miracle, did much better, getting to number 6 in May of 1974, their last dent in the UK chart.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
My mate bought a toaster. We go through celebrities' Amazon purchase histories so you don't have to. Keep calm and love Dom Jolly novelty keyring and fridge magnets.
Yeah, I love that.
The G-spot.
The good vibrations, guys.
Green dot laser sight rifle gun scope.
I've bought that quite a lot of times, I think.
Right, okay. The sex doctor's guide to keeping it hot.
Ah, interesting.
Did another child come along 9 months later?
Yeah.
Loads of great eps up now, and new ones dropping every Monday. That's My Mate Bought a Toaster from Great Big Al.
Hello. That was fab. Limmy and a Family Cooking. Ooh, hang on. I have a word with the director. Hello, is that the director? Good. Can I bring some cows next week? It's all right, they're house trained. Ooh. These BBC people, you know, asked to put on a show, try and get a few cows in it, and what do they say? Something I can't repeat, I can tell you. Meanwhile, we have violins. You know, love is like a violin. Well, here's a group that's just like a violin.
all varnished and covered in string. It's Eye Level by the Simon Park Orchestra.
The camera pans away and swoops across a studio, alighting upon a group of confused-looking lads. We eventually discover Everett, sitting at their feet, whooping. After he pretends to communicate with the director on a walkie-talkie, his spiel is cut by a graphic of the number one on a plinth with all pulsing searchlights around it. And when he comes back into shot, Everett introduces the toppermost single of the week, Eye Level by the Simon Park Orchestra. We covered Eye Level, the theme tune to the Thames TV detective serial Van der Valk, in Chart Music 17. It was composed by Jan Struckert, loosely based on a Dutch-German nursery rhyme, and was performed by an orchestra led by Simon Park, who was born in Market Harborough in 1946. On its original release in late 1972, it only got to number 41. But when the second series was broadcast from the end of August and became one of the top-rated TV shows in the country, it was released again, entered the charts at number 48, then soared 34 places to number 14, and then soared all the way to number 1, shoving Angel Fingers by Wizard off the summit of Mount Pop. This is his third week at the top, and here's Simon and his amazing mustard roll-necked band in the studio to conjure up the serene majesty of old Amsterdam.
Playing it to a thoroughly bemused audience, really. I mean, you know, sort of, I'm sure only a few years from now, 73, later on in the 70s, if there was, say, a TV theme tune, what you'd have is a video that was fundamentally clips from the TV show. So that's what would have happened. In this era, you have to get the full frickin' orchestra in. Yeah. Eye Level's not massively objectionable. It's odd that it's at number one because it
You usually take up for this sort of thing, don't you, Neil?
Well, it's just, it's a novelty in a sense. It's odd that it's number one because I doubt this got much radio play, did it? I'm pretty sure that the BBC did their best to
Radio 2 play it would have been all over it, surely.
Oh, absolutely. Radio 1, I'm sure, did their best to play it as infrequently as possible, apart from on the chart shows, and were quite sniffy about it, I should imagine.
Yeah.
It's weird that the full orchestra are here playing it, but you have to have the actual performers here. It's inoffensive in a way. It's another, they have to get the number one on, so I can't exactly call it time-wasting.
Yeah.
But it's an odd thing that it gets that high without any radio support. And, you know, I ask the question as ever with songs like this, who's buying it?
Shannonor, isn't it?
Well, I guess so. But, you know, the program's on every week. Can't they just watch it and hear this? I don't get the thing of needing to buy the theme tune.
You can put it on a tape cassette player and walk about your local canal and pretend you're in Amsterdam.
I guess so. But have you ever watched an entire episode of Van der Valk?
No.
Yeah, this is it. Nor have I. Never.
No.
I've never watched, in fact, I've never watched more than 2 minutes of it.
Taylor has. He says it's not up to
Of
much.
Course Taylor has.
Yes. Apparently there's no such thing as a Simon Park Orchestra, and this is actually our old favourites, the Top of the Pops Orchestra, doing a bit of moonlighting for beer money. So, a very rare sighting of a perennial chart music favourite. And, they look like they sound pretty much, don't they?
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned the audience looking bemused because we do see a lot of the audience in this episode and they do often look bemused, whether it's by Engelbert or by Kenny Everett or by something like this. By the way, those lads who the camera pans across to and he's sort of squatting at their feet, they're wearing these matching jumpers. I don't know if you noticed this, but two of them say house and one says tree. Anyone got any idea what that was all about?
No, just,
I don't know what that was promoting.
No idea.
But speaking of jumpers, the mustard polar necks are back. I bet they haven't been washed since last time. The flautist looks like Eric Sykes. They all look like Eric Sykes, let's be honest.
Yes.
They just they do.
Yes.
There's
one bloke, I think he's playing the flute or something, and he's got a St. Christopher on a chain.
Right.
But for some reason, he's got the chain tucked under his armpit.
What the fuck?
Well, it's like he's wearing this really long fucking Dennis Wheatley amulet thing. And it's on a really massive long chain. And that's what he does when he plays his instrument so it doesn't get tangled up. It's very strange.
Could be, yeah. I've never seen Van der Valk. I had never seen Van der Valk. So I did watch a bit for research for this. Well, yeah, yeah. And I'm inclined to take Taylor's view on it. It's so tame and boring. Much like the theme tune. Mm. I mean, this theme tune has no balls, right? Compare it to some of the great cop show or detective show themes of the 70s. The Rockford Files, Kojak, Starsky and Hutch, The Sweeney, The Professionals. All of those tunes, super exciting. And then this, right? Which could easily be the theme for Swallow, the regional detective show set in Norwich that Alan Partridge pitches to Tony Hayes. That could be the theme. But it does, like I say, weirdly match the show. So you've got a detective series set in Amsterdam, especially 70s Amsterdam, which has the potential for all kinds of sleaze and dirt and danger and edge. But the show, from what I can gather from skimming through, didn't have that, and the theme tune definitely does not. There are plot lines involving S&M, prostitution, the Amsterdam transsexual scene, and so on, but they're much more likely, from what I could see from the episode summaries, to involve concert pianists, stonemasons, or a mouse there on the stair with clogs on. I happened upon a scene where Van der Valk is in a jewellery shop, and a very camp proprietor says, "You won't find anything bent in this establishment, I assure you." And Van der Valk growls, "The last thing I'm looking for." And that's, you know, yeah. But it's quite a contrast for Barry Foster, the actor who plays Van der Valk, because in 1972, the year Van der Valk started, he was also in Hitchcock's Frenzy. Frenzy being arguably the wrongest of all Hitchcock's films, some of which were already quite wrong. And Foster plays Rusk, the rapist murderer, who growls, "Lovely, lovely, lovely," while his victim recites Psalm 91. It's pretty much the anti-Van der Valk. Yeah, so Simon Park did the music for Crown Court, but as we've established, he didn't write this. As you said, he's written by, well, Jack Tromby, the pseudonym for Jan Stockart. At least he was actually from Amsterdam, Stockart, and the title Eye Level being a joke about the flat horizons of the Low Countries. Tromby also did the theme for Never the Twain and incidental music for Dawn of the Dead, but that's kind of it. It's not a very glorious CV that he's got. And as you say, the tune is loosely based on those German/Dutch nursery rhymes. I think it's Jan Hinnek in German and Katutje in Dutch from the 18th century.
Right.
I actually bothered to listen to both of those, right? And the German one, I actually found a sort of English translation sung of the German one. It's about a violin maker. He makes a small violin, which is referred to, for fuck's sake, as a fiddlekin in the English translation. I mean, twee as fuck, right? A fiddlekin, fuck off. And the Dutch one involves a really awful dance, I guess a clog dance. And just nobody involved in either of them has ever had sexual intercourse. It's just, I hate the way Eye Level primly prances along and everything melodically is neatly resolved. There's no melodic turbulence. It's pangloss pop. It's music for people who think that all is for the best in this best of all possible worlds. And it is baffling at number one. Yeah, who is buying it? It's more baffling, I would say, than Moldy Old Dough or something like that.
Yeah.
It's not even like, you know, Ki Mai by Morricone?
Yeah. Yes.
Where at least you can see the appeal of that. It's quite a beautiful piece of music, even though it's not an obvious pop hit. But this, right? Imagine if you were visiting the UK from America in October 1973.
Yes.
Imagine you were David Cassidy, for example. And when you go home, people ask you, "What are people listening to over there? What's number one in the UK?" And you have to say, "Oh, well, there's this orchestra." And I mean, fucking hell.
Yeah, it's...
What this track says, what it says to the viewer, right? Even more than Engelbert, it says, "Fun time's over, go home." And that's how you'd have felt, I reckon, as a child. Yeah. Back to your toy soldiers or your Secret Seven books or staring at the orange...
Or your homework.
Yeah, your homework or staring at the orange and brown pattern on the carpet waiting for the future to happen.
Yeah, it's insipid as fuck. And it's, I think the people who got it to number one are that segment of the pop market that we frequently come up against in chart music. Are you people who don't really like music? Or just want it to solve a simple mathematical puzzle, in a sense. And you know, they want it to tick that off and have a sense of completion. And excitement really isn't part of what they want from music. They want a sense of clarity and satisfaction, if you like. Which, of course, is not kids. I'd be sat at home. I'd have walked out of the room by now. Imagine being one of those kids who's, you know, waited for your ticket to Top of the Pops. You get there this is your number one. You know, fuck me. That'd be gutting.
You've got to watch the fucking Eric Sykes band.
Yeah, yeah, basically.
Yeah, at least it's fucking memorable. At least you know what the tune's like after you've listened to it. What's happened to television theme tunes?
Well, television theme tunes have a different job now, right?
Yeah.
You know when you watch a documentary now and the documentary can't just start, it has to actually say everything that's going to happen in the next hour and then go on to unpack it. It has to have that 5-minute preamble. Yeah. In a similar way, theme tunes, well, what are they there for now? I don't remember any of the theme tunes to some of my most favourite shows. At the moment, you know, those favourite shows being obviously high quality content like Forged with Fire and, you know, things like that. I don't know what purpose theme tunes serve anymore.
Because I can remember entire school trip journeys on a bus filled by kids bellowing out theme tunes note for note and word for word. From the minute we left the school to the minute we actually got there.
Generation Hazelhurst, yeah.
Well, a lot of TV shows don't have a theme anymore. They just do. Is it called a cold open where the show just sort of starts?
Yeah, cold open. Yeah, or it's just a sting.
A little sting. Yeah, like 2 seconds of it or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Fucking rubbish.
But I'd probably prefer that to fucking Eye Level. I'll be honest.
Yeah, too. Right. I mean, thank God for the skip intro possibilities of current television viewing.
Imagine if the theme for The Professionals was number one, though. That'd be amazing.
Yes, exactly.
And that's more like
imagine
it.
Imagine pants people dancing to that, or Legs and Co.
Yeah. Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt.
Yeah, people running around kicking doors open. And
sexy bodies.
Yeah, yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
That's more like it.
Here's a bit of alternate history. Eye Level gets released the first time round, and it goes up one more place to number 40.
And that's it.
And that's it.
Yeah.
Fucking hell.
That means that in this month, My Friend Stan and Ballroom Blitz by Sweet are number ones.
What a better world we'd be living in.
Eye Level would spend one more week at the top before giving way to Cassidy McLove and his sulky songs about daydreaming and dogs. It would go on to sell just over 1 million copies in the UK, becoming the second biggest single of 1973. One place above Welcome Home by Peters and Lee, one below Tie Your Yellow Ribbon by The Old Oak Tree by Tony Orlando and Dawn, and would become the second biggest selling instrumental single of all time in the UK,
fucking
behind
hell.
Stranger on the Shore by Aka Bilk. The follow-up, Hi Fi, failed to chart, and when two LPs also failed to chart, Park wandered into scoring TV series and films, including Danger UXB. He was last seen on an episode of Bargain Hunt in 2017.
Wow.
Yes.
Buying up copies of his own single like J.R. Hartley.
Yes.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to leave you with Ike and Tina Turner while we say goodnight. What are you looking at? We're going to say goodnight from Top of the Pops. See you next week. But I'm Madeiros Landudno Yucky Dog. Goodbye!
Cut back to a group of kids who are waiting for Everett to do his final bit, which involves him staggering towards the camera with a bandy-legged gait and introducing the final song before falling to the floor. It's Nutbush City Limits by Ike and Tina Turner. Formed in St. Louis in 1957 when Anna Mae Bullock, the then girlfriend of saxophonist Raymond Hill of the Rhythm Kings, convinced bandleader Ike Turner to join them on stage at a bar gig, which led to the latter moving in with the former and eventually getting married in 1962. By the early 60s, they were a regular feature on the US R&B and Billboard charts, but it wasn't until 1966 when they made their first appearance on the UK charts when River Deep Mountain High, which only got to number 88 in America, made it to number 3 for 2 weeks in July of that year. The follow-up, A Love Like Yours, got to number 16 in November of that year, but after a re-release of River Deep Mountain High got to number 33 in March of 69, they left the British charts untouched until now. This is the lead cut from the new LP of the same name, written by Tina about her hometown in Tennessee, and it's the follow-up to Work On Me, which failed to chart. It entered the top 40 at number 32 a month ago, and this week it's up one place to number 4. And my introduction to the single is longer than what we actually hear, because thanks to Everett's pissing about, they've overrun considerably.
Which is gutting, because this is such a fucking great record.
This is the fucking highlight of the episode, as far as I can see.
Yeah.
He can't stop doing his shtick, because, yeah, he comes out with that bandy-legged walk like he's got rickets. And he does, throughout the show, he keeps emerging from backstage with a mysterious energy. And for no apparent reason, he signs off with Llandudno Iechyd goodbye. Like, there's been no mention of anything Welsh, but who knows? But yeah. Fuck's sake, but yeah, you get 39 seconds of the song. I counted. Yeah.
Which is not enough. I mean, I remember first hearing this on the Formula 30. It was one of the songs on that comp. And the fuzziness of it, the guitar solo, everything about this record is fantastic. And it's a really important point, of course, in Tina Turner's career, I think. Because, there's a lot of late 60s, early 70s songs about the longing for home, if you like, trying to find a home, trying to go back home, or being confused about, you know, where or what home means anymore. For Tina Turner, her hometown is Nutbush, Tennessee. And in a sense, this could be a song about it. Normally, you'd expect songs about home to be, oh, I want to get back there. This absolutely isn't. This is all about why she doesn't want to go back there, why she isn't there anymore. Of course, it's not known to the general public at this time just to what an abusive and volatile marriage she's in with Ike at the moment. And during these kind of years, you know, it's getting as bad as it gets with his alcoholism and his cocaine addiction. I think this song, perhaps I'm putting too much on it, but I think it might have played a big part of her eventual self-liberation, if you like. She leaves Ike with nothing, you know. All she's not Ike with nothing, but her with nothing. She's got what, her Buddhism, and that's about it.
Did she take on all the debts and everything?
I think she
just to get the fuck away from him.
This is a song about roots, about beginnings, about what makes a person a person. I think perhaps I'm putting too much into it, but I think she had a moment of self-realization doing this song and just thought, I'm out. In a sense, she sings it with pride. It's her town and her roots that can't be taken away from her, even though those roots are quite narrow and regulated, as the song kind of explores. But, you know, I think she wrote it as a reminder, in a kind of sense, that before she got on stage in St. Louis to sing with Ike, she was her own person, shaped by her own experiences and places, and that was worth remembering. And perhaps it gave her a little impetus in seeking, you know, the fact that it was a success gave her a little impetus in striking out her own course. I was always delighted as well by the rumour, and it is just a rumour, it didn't happen, that Mark Bolan played guitar on this. But it's not the case. No. It's a lovely thought. It's a lovely thought.
I think you've got three Tina Turners, really. You've got 60s Tina Turner, 70s Tina Turner, and 80s Tina Turner. In the 60s, she was this young, raw soul singer. In the 70s, she was this kind of strutting, untamed sexual animal. And in the 80s, she was this jaded older woman who wore leather skirts in the way that middle-aged divorcees do, right?
Yes.
And I, even though I mentioned on a recent episode, our sort of Christmas episode, that I only really became aware of Tina Turner with the Heaven 17 collaboration in the 80s.
Yeah.
The first Tina Turner I ever saw, I'm pretty sure, was her strutting 70s self in a television screening of The Who's Tommy. And that's...
Yes.
That's who we get on Nutbush City Limits. It's a strutting song, isn't it? It's made for Tina to do that pissed, pigeon-toed Charleston she does.
Yeah.
And The thing is, Tina Turner seems all right, doesn't she? Whether or not you like her music, she comes over as a decent, likable person. However, Ike Turner famously was a terrible cunt. And I'm not even going to say but, and I'm not going to offer extenuating circumstances. What I'm going to say is that his own backstory was grim as fuck. His father was kicked to death when Ike was 3 for talking to a white woman. Then Ike was molested by a 45-year-old woman when he was 6 and by two other women before he was 12. And abuse is something that often gets paid forward, and he paid it forward to Tina. Obviously, he's far, far, far from the only person to be violent and abusive to women and also make great music. The mind instantly goes to Phil Spector, who was, of course, responsible for Ike and Tina Turner's greatest moment, River to Mountain High. Weird that the Americans didn't buy that, but there we go. Although Ike had very little to do with that record, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, I could talk about River Deep Mountain High all day. It's one of the most staggering achievements of 20th century humanity. I saw Tina perform it live at the O2 in the noughties, and it was still phenomenal even then. She did it really sort of faithfully, faithful as that puppy. By the way, when I went on Twitter to praise that performance, Alan McGee had a pop at me. Have I mentioned this on a previous chart music?
No.
What's that cunt been saying?
This is 13 years ago or something. But yeah, he had a pop at me for going to see a 60s nostalgia tour, the juggier twat. And I said that was a bit rich coming from the man responsible for Oasis. And
it all comes back to Oasis, doesn't it?
It does. And a full-on row erupted in which he resorted to transphobia, going, "Why don't you get the sex change and move to Thailand? You'd like it there." He tweeted that at me.
Fucking hell.
Yeah, and he went on about me wearing a dress, and then he blocked me because he couldn't handle it. And this was all because I enjoyed seeing Tina Turner do River Deep Mountain High, the mad gacked up Anyway... Speaking of mad gacked up cunts, let's go back to Ike Turner. Right? Obviously, Ike Turner was involved in some great things. Going back to 1951, Rocket 88 by Jackie Brenston and his Delta Cats, who were actually Ike Turner's Kings of Rhythm, and that's considered by some to be the first rock and roll record. Then there's Peaches and Cream by the Ikettes, his backing singers. Do you know that one?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a bit of a Northern Soul classic. I love it. It's amazing.
If I may, I'd like to chuck in "I Can't Believe What You Say" in the mid-60s and "Bold Soul Sister" in about 1969. Two fucking mint singles.
Right.
I can't believe they didn't get any more sexy British chart action in the 1960s. Mm. Ridiculous.
Absolutely. And there's this track called "Dust My Broom," which I've read loads of books about Northern Soul, and they tend to have lists of the best Northern Soul floor fillers ever. And "Dust My Broom" by Ike and Tina Turner kept cropping up, highly placed on these lists. And it became a bit of a holy grail for me. When I finally heard it through the magic of the internet, because you couldn't find a fucking vinyl copy anywhere,
no,
I could see the fuss, even if that's mostly to do with Tina's vocal performance. And Ray Charles produced it, his production. But I'm sort of like dodging the issue of Nutbush City Limits here, and I've got to part company with Neil. I don't like it. I've got to concede that it's quite inventive musically for a soul record of that time, with the use of the clavinet and the Moog solo, and of course the wah-wah guitar, and yeah, there is that urban myth about Mark Bolan. Gloria Jones was responsible for spreading that rumour, by the way. But yeah, I mean, I've seen it debunked, and Occam's Razor points to it being James Bino Lewis of the Kings of Rhythm. I mean, we'll never know for sure, but what we do know is that the song has that oompa oompa stick it up your jumper rhythm, which I personally find...
No, I'm not listening to you, Simon. Don't spoil it for
which I find grating, personally. One problem I have with Nutbush City Limits is that I don't care about Nutbush, right? And it's a general problem I have with songs which get super local in the title. The other day, right, with our Sunday lunch, I put on Atlantic Black Gold, 20 Great Soul Hits by Original Artists. And side one, track two was Funky Nassau by Beginning of the End, right?
Yes.
And
look, a tune.
Well, I'm glad you're proud of your town, and I'm glad you had a nice time at your recording session, but Nassau means nothing to me. Or Stainsby Girls by Chris Rea, right? I don't understand what's exceptional about these girls to the point where you actually name the school or the town. They're just a universal...
Hang on, I remember you sticking up for Urshan Boys in an earlier episode of Chart Music.
Well, look, I never said I'm consistent, right? But Stainsby girls are just a universal archetype of slightly wild, footloose teenage heartbreaker. Also, Penny Lane by the Beatles. Fuck off. I'm glad Penny Lane's in your heart, right? But you haven't given me any reason why it should be in mine, right? And I feel like that about Nutbush City Limits. I don't get what we're meant to take from this description of a boring, slightly uptight and repressive southern town. I've heard it said that that the line, "You have to watch what you're putting down in old Nutbush," is somehow a coded reference to racism. But, you know, it flies way under the radar, if so.
Right.
I went on Google Maps and I, in inverted commas, drove around Nutbush. And it didn't take long because it's barely an actual place. It's got 259 people. It's basically just a road intersection with a gin distillery and a church. So it literally is church house, gin house.
Right.
So it hasn't changed since Tina's day. By the way, I don't know about you, when she goes church house, gin house, schoolhouse, outhouse, in my mind, I always think she's going to say outhouse, shit house. It's every time. The main road through Nutbush is now called Tina Turner Highway. So they're proud of her, even if her song makes it sound like a really shit place.
Yeah, yeah.
And because of this thing of it being really specific to her and being her town, I don't get why it's become such a standard for bands to cover. It fucking pub bands, you hear it everywhere. Maybe this is part of the reason why it does my head in, because you just fucking hear Nutbush City Limits everywhere. It's not like it's about New Orleans or New York. I just think that below a certain population size, if there's a place mentioned in a song, you've probably never been there, nor do you have any concept of what it's like. It's someone else's very specific memory. Why are you singing it like it's your own? And I also hate Proud Mary by Tina Turner for similar reasons. Why are we supposed to care about a fucking boat? Why has that become a standard?
Well, it's a Creedence song, isn't it, originally?
Well, yeah, I know, but people sing the Tina Turner.
You know why this song is covered, Nutbush City Limits is covered so often? It's because it does straddle two genres, in a sense. It's got a kind of funk to it, but it's a rock song, essentially. That's why, you know, when Brian Johnson auditions for AC/DC, this is one of the songs that he covers to get that gig. And he does it pretty well, apparently, and gets the AC/DC job. And that's why Bob Seger covers it as well. You know, it's one of those that straddles the kind of thing. For me, it's the sonic confection aspect of it. It's just the fuzz. I love it, and I love the guitar solo in it and the chunkiness of the beat more than perhaps what the song's actually about. So that's probably why, that probably explains my liking of it a bit more. But it does straddle the kind of rock and funk genres, and that's why it keeps cropping up in bands doing it, because they're proving something, in a sense, or they think that they can cross the racial tracks a little bit with what
play
they're
that
doing.
Funky music, white boy.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's good. Obviously, there's plenty that's good about it, but I think I've just heard it too many times, you know.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? That's exactly it.
I mean, we only get 39 seconds with a fisheye lens shot of the crowd dancing, so it's relatively painless, and it's better than the Simon Park Orchestra, I'll give it that. It's a little bit of a lift at the end. It lifts you out of that, at least.
So the following week, Nutbush City Limits stayed at number 4 before slithering downward. The follow-up, Sweet Rhode Island Red, failed to chart, and they split up in Dallas in 1976 when Ike assaulted Tina again in a car, leading her to hiding in a hotel and then at assorted mates' houses before filing for divorce. Of course, she went on to make a solo comeback in the 80s, and this song made another appearance in the charts when an updated re-recording got to number 23 for 2 weeks in September of 1991. And that, Pop Craze Youngsters, closes the book on this episode of Top of the Pops, and closes the book on Kenny Everett's career on Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
Right after this episode, he gave a guided tour of the studio and was interviewed by a couple of 13-year-old kids for the John Cravens News Round spin-off show Search, which was broadcast in November. The blurb: are pop fans being exploited, and has fan mania reached a new danger point? Beth Miller and John Monaghan, both aged 13, talked to top DJs about today's pop scene and discussed their findings with other children. They interviewed Tony Blackburn and Jimmy Savile. I've looked all over for the episode. It's not on YouTube, but there is the clip, the interview clip with Kenny Everett, which shows him walking around the actual studio and showing us everything. It's massively informative.
Oh, right.
They ask him if Top of the Pops overdo the special effects or not. if groups are over-relying on miming. And when he's asked about his favourite music, he says Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto. And they start laughing because they think he's taking the piss. No. When he's asked about commercial radio, he reckons it's going to be great and will give Radio 1, quote, a kick up the beebs. And when asked about what he'd do to improve Top of the Pops, he says it should be live, like Ready, Steady, Go was, so everyone can see the mistakes. He comes off as less mature than the 13-year-old interviewers.
Yeah, not surprised.
With a slight snottiness about Pop, I mean, he did love his classical. I suspect that if he was still alive, with that and his Thatcherite politics, he'd undoubtedly be on Classic FM by now.
10 days after this episode, Kenny Everett commenced his career on Capital Radio and wouldn't be seen or heard of again by anyone outside of London for another 5 years. Although, of course, his voice would live on in Charlie the Cat on the public information films and as the voice of Celebrity Squares, not to mention countless adverts. He initially continued as a Sunday afternoon DJ on Capital until a drop in listenership and revenue led to him being reunited with his former Radio London co-host Dave Cash and moved to the breakfast slot, returning to BBC Radio in October of 1981 for a Saturday morning slot on Radio 2. In the meantime, his Radio 1 spot and presenting gig on Top of the Pops was given to...
DLT?
Dave Lee Travis. Thanks, Kenny. So what's on TV afterwards? Well, BBC One pitches into Mastermind. Then it's the first part of Eastwood with Attenborough, where David Attenborough dosses around Southeast Asia, talking very quietly around some animals. This week he's in a bat cave in Borneo, the size of St. Paul's Cathedral. After the 9 o'clock news, it's the show-jumping bit of the Horse of the Year show, followed by the Current Affairs show midweek, hosted by Ludovic Kennedy, and they finish off with Late Night News, the documentary series Coral World about the reefs of Comoro in the Indian Ocean, regional news in your area, and the weather. BBC Two kick on with highlights from the golf, then it's part three of their dramatisation of Jane Eyre, then a one-off episode of The Two Ronnies with a guest appearance by the people of Pan, then it's the Polish documentary Europa, about five people born in Britain to Polish parents who went to Katowice in June to visit grandparents they'd never met before, walk about in the footsteps of their mams and dads, watch Poland spank England 2-0, and talk about which country they'll be supporting next week. And they round off the night with News Extra and an examination of the world of television in real time. ITV is still running the arse end of the Columbo film, followed by the Current Affairs show this week. Then it's the Streets of San Francisco. Now, there's a fucking theme tune. Followed by the news at 10, the film show Cinema, where Brian Truman looks at the people who have made some of the most familiar film scores of the past few years. Then it's the 1962 prison escape film The Break, featuring Tony Britton, Robert Urquhart and John Junkin, and they close down at 12:30. So, boys, what are we talking about in the playground tomorrow?
Probably Kenny Everett's unfunniness and irritation and the kind of just dreary elements of the show, more than the exciting elements in a way. For an episode from 73, and we were talking about this being a golden era, I think in terms of the presentation, the staging, the graphics and everything else, it is a golden era. In terms of the music featured, less so. Much less so.
Because I was a child, Kenny Everett, definitely, you know. Did you see that mad guy running amok? Mm. I missed the meeting where you're meant to say amok. we'd all have been doing impressions of the bits we could remember and running around doing zany faces for a day or two. Mm-hmm. But as an adult, he annoys me.
Yeah, just like with the Roscoe episode, whenever the presenter is the main topic of conversation in the Top of the Pops, that's a bad sign. Mm. It's not Kenny Everett's day yet. He'd get that in a few years' time when Thames bunged him in with Barry Cryer and let him get on with it. But you can't do that on Top of the Pops.
No, I don't think so.
What are we buying on Saturday?
Tina, Spinners, Quo ELO, I think.
Showdown by ELO for definite. maybe Ghetto Child by Detroit Spinners, maybe Caroline by Quo, and At a Push, maybe even Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. But yeah, ELO Showdown is the one.
And what does this episode tell us about October of 1973?
I think in terms of Top of the Pops, this episode may well be a response, in a way, to the absolute slagging that the 500th episode got. And you know, in a sense, to reassure, I don't know, those older people who were looking down on Top of the Pops a bit, that, hey, you know, it's not just all about mindless youthful pop. Well, Top of the Pops should be about mindless youthful pop.
Exactly.
You know, it absolutely should be a programme that, for me, is dominated by what young people want to see on the show, not anyone else. And unfortunately, what we see here is a kind of halfway house. A few moments of excitement where you can see the kids getting into it. A few moments of complete bemusement where the kids are like, what is this shit?
It tells us that Britain's just waiting for punk rock to give it the kick up the arse it so badly needs. No. I think, for me, it's the rise, or the resurgence, maybe, of the teen idol. It's the hidden force here. It's waiting in the wings. 1973 was the year David Bowie released Pinups, and by calling his album that, he captured the zeitgeist, because pinup culture was in the ascendant, and you can feel it here, even in absentia, with the ghost of David Cassidy lurking behind the chart countdown and his next single waiting to usurp Slade. And you can kind of see a passing on of the baton, or rather a snatching away of the baton from good-natured British uglies like Slade to beautiful American angels like David Cassidy and, of course, Donny Osmond. I mean, bless them, but did people fancy Dave Hill? Maybe. Noddy? Not Noddy, surely. I don't know. Mark Bolan was beautiful, and he arguably started all this, but he was just about to go off the boil. His next single, Truck on Tyke, was his first to miss the top 10 since shortening the band's name to T-Rex. So this was David Cassidy's moment, and David Essex was also on the rise. The following year, we'd have the Bay City Rollers properly taking off, and you'd even have people like Spark sending the girls crazy. Jackie magazine was at its peak. And the best-selling issue ever of Jackie was a David Cassidy front cover in 1972. Yeah. So it was a time of pin-ups and teen hysteria and a resurgence in scream ages, which hadn't been seen since the Beatles a decade earlier. And, of course, we didn't need the Beatles anymore because we had the Electric Light.
And that, Pop Craze Youngsters, brings us to the end of this episode. All that remains now is the usual promotional flange, www.chart-music.co.uk, facebook.com/chartmusicpodcast, reach out to us on Twitter at chartmusictotp, video playlist bit.ly/cm57vids, money down the G-string, patreon.com/chartmusic. Very much, Neil Kulkarni.
No worries, Al.
God bless you, Simon Price.
Thank you. Loads of fun. Cheers.
My name's Al Needham, and I'm still reeling from the shock that I could be presenting a podcast with Jesus Price and Buzz Kulkarni.
Unimaginative parents, man.
Chart music.
GreatBigOwl.com.
Hello, my name is Pete Ellison. This is Dave Cribb.
Hello, and we do a podcast called Friends with Friends, as you might have guessed from the music that's playing underneath, which is a sort of lo-fi rendition of the Friends theme tune for rights reasons. We get a different guest on every week on our podcast to talk about their favourite episode of Friends.
And we look through it in excruciating detail. We pick through levels of plot like no one has ever done before.
So if you like Friends, or just listening to people talking, which are both valid activities, do look us up on the old podcast apps and that. Friends with Friends, and we're on Twitter at FriendsWF.
Runner, more nights over.
off a fella. Oh, nice pulley. Oh, I love offer. Oh, nice Michelle. Oh, I don't love anybody. Nobody likes me. My name is Phil. I love cafe. I'm a motor mechanic. She was down a cafe. My name's Brian Mitchell. Sharon's me lover. If you don't like it, I'll come round and knock ya. With the ace they lose, I'll give her monkeys. Come on down and walk it. Spresser only 28p.